Welcome to KG News Morning Magazine. It's September 26th of 2022. I'm your host, Christian Garibay. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear about what CU Boulder is doing to address sexual misconduct on and off campus. And CityCast Denver asks what Denver Metro officials can learn from Houston's seemingly highly effective response to homelessness. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC headlines and then the Hightower Lowdown. After that, it's a public affair with the Community Foundation of Boulder County. Host Jim Williams will sit down with the executive director of the Boulder Economic Council. Then at 9 a.m., we'll bring you Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Leland Rucker will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that is still ahead this morning, but first, these headlines with KGN News' Kiara Damari.
Workers at a Starbucks in Greeley will vote on whether to unionize this Tuesday. The workers expect an easy victory, as 90% of them signed on to the petition to the National Labor Relations Board to hold the vote. The balloting process will take place in two shifts, one in the morning and in the afternoon, at the 11th Avenue location in Greeley. Officials will tally the votes at 6 p.m. If approved, the Greeley location will be the 8th Starbucks in Colorado to unionize. Workers at more than 230 Starbucks locations nationwide have voted in favor of union representation in the last year. A lawsuit is forcing the city of Boulder to reevaluate its ban on oil and gas development with city limits. John and Valerie Wells argue that the ban took their property and mineral rights without due composition. In 2013, the city implemented what was supposed to be a temporary prohibition on gas and oil development in Boulder. However, that ended up lasting 8 years. On Friday, the city government settled with Wells for $35,000 and agreed to lift the ban. In November, Boulder voters can agree to forego the municipal control of the Boulder Public Library for a property tax-funded district. If it goes through, the library would be fully transferred by 2024, and the city predicts it would save at least $9.7 million. According to the Daily Camera, some of the proposals for the money so far include construction, staffing a permanent day service center for people experiencing homelessness, or park maintenance. Election deniers across Colorado are inundating county officials with public record requests while officials gear up for midterm elections. KGNU's Jack Armstrong has more.
Election deniers across the state are sending Colorado Open Records Act requests under the guise of mass fraud across the country. The requests are collectively asking for obscure pieces of voter information, which are usually negligible to the public. Election denier Tony Rambo, who sent over 60 requests across each county, even mentioned that he has no idea what the requests are actually asking for. He is just doing the legwork. Colorado County officials told CBS Colorado that the flood of court requests right before the midterm elections is a morale killer. According to the executive director of Colorado County Clerks Association, smaller Colorado counties are saying the requests are overwhelming for them, and they have been hearing reports of similar things happening to county clerks across the country. For KGNU, I'm Jack Armstrong.
After one of the sharpest inclines in the country, Denver's housing market has begun to slow. Housing prices were down almost 2% in August compared to last year, and the number of houses on the market has also increased, going from about 1,000 last year to 15 this August. The increased price and supply has translated to more time on the market. Average homes on Redfin's most recent survey report show houses are taking about 11 days to sell, compared to last year's 7. Denver's increased housing prices is part of a nationwide trend. Across the county, housing prices have begun to fall and are about 2% lower than they were last year. Many point to a higher interest rate. The federal government increased the interest rate to over 6% to slow inflation, and in part to discourage wealthy investment firms from buying up houses in areas like Denver. Denver's housing slowdown ranked 5th in the country along with Sacramento. While researchers say more expensive markets tend to slow more quickly, they warn buyers from oversimplifying the recent market trends. There has been a lot of talk of a new normal, but what's happening in the housing market feels more like a new weird. Redfin Deputy Chief Economist Tyler Marr said to the Denver Post. Today, in Fort Collins, there's a high of 83 and a low of 44. In Boulder, a high of 79 and a low of 49. And in Denver, there's a high of 83 and a low of 47. For KGNU, I'm Kiara Jamari.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Christian Garibay. CU Boulder is taking a new approach to dealing with sexual misconduct among the student body. The new Sexual Misconduct Task Force will host a town hall from 4 to 5:30 p.m. today, in person and online, to answer questions about how misconduct is addressed on campus. KGNU's Claire Purnell reports.
CU Boulder's recently formed Sexual Misconduct Task Force is organizing a town hall meeting this afternoon to present the results of a campus sexual misconduct survey and to answer questions about how the university addresses complaints. Hosting the event are the Office of Institutional Equity and Compliance, or the OIEC, and the Office of Victim Assistance, or OVA.
The task force is really about implementing practices that both in 2015 and 2021 and some of the national research point to as ways to reduce risk factors for our community.
Teresa Rowe with the Office of Institutional Equity and Compliance says what sets this new task force apart from past efforts is the way it will work with student populations off campus.
Because we can't implement things that aren't in our kind of purview, the work that we do on campus. So we need that broader reach. We need that broader leadership. And while we've had other task forces and committees in the past, we have lacked that kind of focused leadership. And I think that this will be a real benefit in terms of having this task force take on this issue.
Rowe says part of the strategy involves the Office of Institutional Equity and Compliance, or OIEC, working with fraternities to educate members on issues of consent and on sexual assault prevention.
Education is not enough to solve these problems. But consistent education within the Greek community is really important. And the IFC Hill chapters are unaffiliated with the university and have their own advisor and leadership. But the student leadership of the fraternities really took it on this last year to say, we're adding to our bylaws that all new members, every chapter, every year has to have education on sexual assault prevention, consent. And so that it, having that be more consistent and having them, you know, over the years really work with us in terms of how can they shift their culture? What are some things that they really want to see change for their community and really partnering with them to reduce these problems from happening in the fraternity community and the Greek community in general.
A campus culture survey conducted in 2021 found that approximately 15% of undergraduate women say they had experienced sexual assault since coming to CU Boulder. Fraternity houses were the most common locations for these assaults, according to survey results. Julie Volkins, also of the OIEC, says a few factors contribute to the higher risk environment.
There are more social events happening in chapter houses. Chapter houses are typically large with lots of locations inside the house where people can go to talk and to connect and to have consensual sex, but also to be in a context where sexual assault can occur and not many people are witnessing that. So it's the sexual assault happens when other people are around, you know, at least two people are together. That situation is optimized in a chapter house.
The 2021 Campus Culture Survey follows up on a previous one conducted in 2015. Overall, the results indicated a decrease in the number of sexual assault incidents, but found an increase in rates of assault through incapacitation, force, and physical threats. Teresa Rowe says both 2015 and 2021 surveys pointed to fraternity chapter homes and off-campus house parties as the highest risk locations.
So we know those, particularly those social environments where drinking is the primary focus, that those issues are associated in our society, and the attitudes around consent and people drinking are problematic. And that is a cultural problem that we have to address. And that it's a hard one because it's not just CU culture. It's our entire kind of social culture and the college culture. So we have a big battle here in terms of shifting some of these behaviors, and shifting attitudes is quite challenging.
Another societal-wide issue identified by the Sexual Misconduct Task Force members has to do with the sex education students receive prior to arriving on campus. Jessica Ladd-Wiebert of CU Boulder's Office of Victims Assistance says conversations about consent and norms should be happening much earlier in order to promote a better understanding about what is and is not acceptable behavior.
The conversation is brushed over in high school. We need to be talking about it in middle school, because if it's just brushed over until college, it's just too late. So really, we need to be looking at this as a multi-layered, you know, change in all levels of education.
Even with a greater emphasis on the expression of mutual consent ahead of sexual relations, there are still nuances about conditions that often require a better culture of communication. Julie Volkin says these are discussions that are constantly evolving.
This is not a tactic we had in 2015. We added it based on the kinds of incidents that were coming into our office. And so the tactic of going beyond what was mutually agreed upon, high percentage of students indicating that was the tactic. And that really like gets to the heart of what did we agree upon? And so building those skills out.
Being able to separate incidents caused by lack of education or communication from those with intent to harm can help to inform the university's official response. Teresa Rowe says boundaries are not really all that ambiguous when it comes to understanding misconduct and consent.
It's not an intellectual problem that we don't understand boundaries and consent, but we have a lot of negative norms and attitudes around gender, around alcohol, around sex that erode this idea that people have autonomy and choice to decide what they do with their body. Really building some recognition of how that has gotten eroded in the sexual context where there is alcohol present as well, and making some of those implied attitudes a little bit more conscious so people can recognize, be more cognizant of where we fall down in terms of honoring people's boundaries and autonomy in this context.
Students who would like to know more about how CU Boulder hopes to prevent and address sexual misconduct can attend a town hall meeting organized by the university's task force. The session will take place both online and in person in the UMC, room 235, from 4 to 5:30 p.m. For KGNU, I'm Claire Purnell.
Has Houston been so good at tackling its homelessness problem that Denver can take a page from its playbook? A group of local politicians and staff recently made a trip to Texas to see exactly how the country's fourth largest city has housed 25,000 people in the last decade. On today's CityCast Denver, host Bree Davies and producer Paul Caroli sit down with Westward staff writer Connor McCormick Cavanaugh to discuss how Houston's approach to treating homelessness could inform Denver's housing situation.
So there was this trip to Houston, a delegation of elected officials from Denver, the Denver Metro, I'm sorry, because this was Denver and Aurora, flew to Houston on sort of a fact-finding trip because Houston has, according to the New York Times, successfully moved 25,000 people off the streets and into homes in the last 10 years. Connor, can you tell me about that trip in particular for our elected officials?
Yeah, so it was a trip that was organized by the city of Aurora, actually, which is interesting because I had originally just assumed that Denver would have organized it, but Aurora is up to some pretty innovative stuff, even if their politics sometimes seem chaotic.
I was going to say, I feel a push and pull of like Mike Kaufman the mayor doing the sort of cosplaying homelessness stunt. That did not go well. But then there's some very progressive folks on council that want to do something different.
I mean, to his credit, Mike Kaufman went on this trip, and there were two other Aurora City Council members, two Denver City Council members, and then two Denver Metro County Commissioners who went on the trip. And then there were some other staffers from Denver, like the mayor's deputy chief of staff, Evan Dreyer. And so they were going to Houston to on a fact-finding mission, because this article in the New York Times had come out over the summer that was very laudatory of the way that Houston has handled homelessness and housing. And there's an example at the beginning where they're talking about kind of dismantling an encampment in Houston. And the big thing is there were really no issues with the residents of that encampment, because they were all put into housing, transitional housing or permanent supportive housing immediately. And so there was no kind of clashing or where am I going to go or kicking the can down the road.
And which is what's been happening in Denver for 10 years straight.
Yeah, absolutely.
For 10 years straight. Like constant conflicts,
like
on the street
corners
downtown. You
can't go home because you don't have a home, but you can't stay here.
Almost every day. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So they went to Houston to see how it's done.
To see how it's done, to talk with service providers there, to talk with politicians there. They did a site visit of a soon-to-be-finished navigation center that's being built in a former charter school. But then the majority of the time they spent in Houston City Hall just meeting with folks and hearing what's worked. And I reached out to a bunch of the different folks who went on the trip, and I said, hey, what are your lessons learned? And a big one is that Denver Metro really needs to cooperate on homelessness as a region and not have kind of isolated cities and municipalities working on this issue. It has to be a team effort. So it's not just a Denver issue. It's not just an Aurora issue, but everyone has to get on board with this. And we've heard ideas of this for a long time. You know, decades ago, it used to be just viewed as, oh, that's a Denver problem. So if there were people experiencing homelessness in Centennial or Englewood or even Aurora, those folks were just assumed to be Denver's homeless population. And so there was no kind of motivation to help out in that regard. But people are starting to evolve in their mindset. And there seems to be good buy-in for doing a region-wide approach. Now, while there's buy-in, it's you have to actually do it. And so that's what we need to follow going forward.
I appreciated from the New York Times article about Houston, like, this was the main thing that they did, was they broke down those barriers and said, we have to work together or it's not going to work. And I'm always skeptical of articles that say, like, oh, look, this thing solved homelessness. And I don't think they necessarily characterized it that way. But I guess I was skeptical of this trip because I don't know. I got plenty out of that article. What did they do? You know what they saw, Connor? Did Councilman Hines or Councilwoman Sathebaca say anything like revelatory in what they got out of their trip?
Councilman Hines told me something that was very interesting. And it kind of goes to your point of, did they have to go to Houston to figure this out? One of the slides that they got in a PowerPoint presentation there said that Houston got its inspiration for the way that it kind of started working on homelessness from Denver's Road Home, which is
the Hickenlooper era plan to end
homelessness,
right?
Yeah.
This 10-year plan
to end homelessness. And again, I mean, that was the 10-year plan to end homelessness was a tagline that the federal government asked mayors to do across the country. It wasn't Hickenlooper who came up with this idea, although
sure, no, fair. It just his this was
sure.
the era.
This was the era. No, but it was a Hickenlooper project, mm-hmm. the Denver's Road Home, and it obviously didn't get Denver home. It had some positive elements, and one of the big ones was getting entities that worked on homelessness in Denver to collaborate better, get out of their silos, and you know, because there's competition for funding. It's essentially competition for like what specific areas people work on. So these service providers haven't always been super cooperative among each other.
I mean, they have different ideologies too. Like
different
some
ideologies.
Are very rooted in faith-based communities,
sure.
And some are feel the opposite, like that has no place in this system.
Yeah.
And that's like a huge barrier for some people.
Volunteers of America, that's an offshoot of the Salvation Army because they disagreed over philosophy many years ago. And so Denver's Road Home was successful in bringing folks together, but then they kind of, it didn't last for a long time. And that program was not well funded at all.
Can we talk about this other thing that Houston is doing differently? So there's the unifying all these organizations into this one continuum that we don't have. But then they also have really put a priority on what they call a housing first model. How is that different from what we're doing, Connor?
So it's, I mean, in terms of rhetoric, it's no different from what Denver is doing. Denver talks, the mayor talks, Britta Fisher, the head of the Department of Housing Stability. They talk how Denver is housing first. It's this idea that rather than requiring people living on the streets or in shelters to get a job or kick an addiction before they can start accessing housing, the idea is to give them housing, help them connect them with housing first, and then people have a much better chance of figuring out those other difficult things in life, like getting a job if you haven't worked for a while or kicking a tough addiction. And Denver's been talking about this. We had the social impact bond program a few years ago where it was a housing first program and it had really positive results. And we saw people being a lot more successful when Denver used a housing first approach. But Denver doesn't have a truly housing first approach because there isn't enough housing. There isn't enough deeply affordable housing that's, you know, less than 30% of the area median income. So given that it doesn't have enough affordable housing, when sweeps are happening, it's not a housing first approach. There's no, hey, we're going to dismantle your encampment and here's a unit to go into. That it's not that. It's just like we were talking about before, kind of moving people around.
But you're touching on the thing that I think is the biggest issue, one of the biggest issues here. It's very complicated, but that we don't have the housing. And I feel like Councilwoman Say the Baca has talked about that aspect. It's like, when are we going to force some affordability in this private market? Like, how is that going to happen? Because so far, it hasn't. How could we even implement something like Houston's model if we don't have anywhere to house people?
Well, that's where I got to when I was reading the article. And then I kind of turned a corner when I saw a comment that Chris Hines made to our pal Chris Walker at 5280 about this question of, like, what's the real problem? Is it housing? Housing too expensive? Where's the quote-unquote affordable housing? Like, okay, so here's what Chris Hines said. He was recounting a conversation with Houston's homeless czar. And this person apparently said, housing includes three things. So when they're saying housing first, they mean three things: the housing, the funding for the housing, and the funding for supportive services. He said you have to have all three legs of the stool for the stool to stand up. And I thought that was interesting because, and this is Hines saying this, because when people think of housing, they often think of the structure, not necessarily the funding streams related to it. So I think maybe the issue here is that we've been focusing a little too much on the affordability of the units and not enough on finding the money to pay what it costs, whatever it costs. And it's more about our values and our choice to dedicate that funding stream, to actually recognize housing as a right, to recognize this model works, and make that choice.
There's a lot of money in this city, and maybe that's part of the problem. We're just not directing it to the things that are needed, which is to build a housing at whatever it costs, like you're saying, Paul. Like, yeah. We can't change the cost of supplies. We can't change the cost of labor. We have to do something. And what is that?
Two interesting things in the mayor's budget, and this is with American Rescue Plan Act money from the federal government. One, it's about $20 million to purchase a motel and transform it into supportive housing units, which is a great use of pandemic relief money, because that money is not going to repeat itself. It's kind of a one-time thing, so it makes sense to do a one-time purchase. And then there's another one that's also around $20 million to purchase a motel and turn that into a transitional center for people experiencing homelessness, kind of what Houston is almost done building right now in the former charter school and where the politicians visited. It's this idea of you can get people from encampments to this transitional center, and then they're in there. They have kind of a more dignifying, sheltering situation for a short period of time, and then you can get them into housing. So those are two purchases, hopefully, that are coming in the near future.
Well, and I also do want to say, it's not to say that those things aren't also happening. It's just like not enough, you know?
Oh, it's, I'm thinking about dropping the pond.
You know? Yeah, like it's not that there aren't affordable housing developers out there trying to do that. It's not that the city isn't doing it in some capacity. It's just not enough.
That was Westword reporter Connor McCormick Cavanaugh speaking with Bree Davies and Paul Caroli of CityCast Denver.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Christian Garibe. Shannon Young has been our producer. Special thanks to Kiara Damari, Jack Armstrong, Alexis Kenyon, Claire Purnell, and the CityCast Denver crew for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower, and then a public affair with the Community Foundation of Boulder County. That's just after these news headlines from the BBC.